The Theory of Reflexivity. Economic theory is devoted to the study of equilibrium positions. The concept of an equilibrium is very useful. It allows us to focus on the final outcome rather than on the process that leads up to it. But the concept is also very deceptive. It has the aura of something empirical. Since the adjustment process is supposed to lead to an equilibrium position seems somehow implicit in our observations. That is not true. Equilibrium itself has rarely been observed in real life. Market prices have a notorious habit of fluctuating. The process that can be observed is supposed to move toward an equilibrium. Why is it that the equilibrium is never reached? It is true that market participants adjust to market prices, but they may be adjusting to a constantly moving target. In that case, calling the participants' behavior an adjustment process may be a misnomer, and equilibrium theory becomes irrelevant to the real world. Equilibrium is the product of an axiomatic system. Economic theory is constructed like logic or mathematics. It is based on certain postulates, and all of its conclusions are derived from them by logical manipulation. The possibility that equilibrium is never reached need not invalidate the logical construction, but when a hypothetical equilibrium is presented as a model of reality, a significant distortion is introduced. If we lived in a world in which the angles of a triangle did not add up to 180 degrees, Euclidean geometry would constitute such a misleading model. The crowning achievement of the axiomatic approach is the theory of perfect competition. Although it was first propounded nearly 200 years ago, it has never been superseded. Only the method of analysis has been refined. The theory holds that under certain specified circumstances, the unrestrained pursuit of self-interest leads to the optimum allocation of resources. The equilibrium point is reached when each firm produces at a level where its marginal cost equals the market price, and each consumer buys an amount whose marginal utility equals the market price. Analysis shows that the equilibrium position maximizes the benefit of all participants, provided no individual buyer or seller can influence market prices. It is this line of argument that has served as the theoretical underpinning for the laissez-faire policies of the 19th century, and it is also the basis of the current belief in the magic of the marketplace. Let us examine the main assumptions of the theory of perfect competition. Those that are spelled out include perfect knowledge, homogeneous and divisible products, and a large enough number of participants so that no single participant can influence the market price. The assumption of perfect knowledge is suspect because understanding a situation in which one participates cannot qualify as knowledge. That was the assumption that I found so unacceptable as a student. I have no doubt that classical economists used the assumption in exactly that sense in which I found it objectionable, because 19th century thinkers were less aware of the limitations of knowledge than we are today. As the epistemological problems began to surface, exponents of the theory found that they could get by using a more modest word, information. In its modern formulation, the theory merely postulates perfect information. Unfortunately, this assumption is not quite sufficient to support the construction of the theory. To make up for the deficiency, modern economists resorted to an ingenious device. They insisted that the demand and supply curves should be taken as given. They did not present this as a postulate. Rather, they based their claim on methodological grounds. They argued that the task of economics is to study the relationship between supply and demand, and not either by itself. Demand may be a suitable subject for psychologists. Supply may be the province of engineers or management scientists. Both are beyond the scope of economics. Therefore, both must be taken as given. Yet, if we stop to ask what it means that the conditions of supply and demand are independently given, it is clear that an additional assumption has been introduced. Otherwise, where would those curves come from? We are dealing with an assumption disguised as a methodological device. Participants are supposed to choose between alternatives in accordance with their scale of preferences. The unspoken assumption is that the participants know what those preferences and alternatives are. As I shall try to show, this assumption is untenable. The shape of the supply and demand curves cannot be taken as independently given because both of them incorporate the participants' expectations about events that are shaped by their own expectations. Nowhere is the role of expectations more clearly visible than in financial markets. Buy and sell decisions are based on expectations about future prices, and future prices, in turn, are contingent on present buy and sell decisions. To speak of supply and demand as if they were determined by forces that are independent of the market participants' expectations is quite misleading. The situation is not quite so clear-cut in the case of commodities, where supply is largely dependent on production and demand on consumption. But the price that determines the amounts produced and consumed is not necessarily the present price. On the contrary, market participants are more likely to be guided by future prices, either as expressed in futures markets or as anticipated by themselves. In either case, it is inappropriate to speak of independently given supply and demand curves because both curves incorporate the participants' expectations about future prices. The very idea that events in the marketplace may affect the shape of the demand and supply curves seems incongruous to those who have been reared on classical economics. The demand and supply curves are supposed to determine the market price. If they were themselves subject to market influences, prices would cease to be uniquely determined. Instead of equilibrium, we would be left with fluctuating prices. This would be a devastating state of affairs. All the conclusions of economic theory would lose their relevance to the real world. It is to prevent this outcome that the methodological device that treats the supply and demand curves as independently given was introduced. Yet there is something insidious about using a methodological device to obscure an assumption that would be untenable if it were spelled out. To preserve the integrity of economic theory as an axiomatic system, its assumptions ought to be explicitly stated. We may then conclude that economic theory is no more relevant to the real world than non-Euclidean geometry, but at least we would know where we stand. Instead, we have been deceived by a methodological subterfuge. The demand and supply curves are presented in textbooks as though they were grounded in empirical evidence. But there is scant evidence for independently given demand and supply curves. Anyone who trades in markets where prices are continuously changing knows that participants are very much influenced by market developments. Rising prices often attract buyers, and vice versa. How could self-reinforcing trends persist if supply and demand curves were independent of market prices? Yet even a cursory look at commodity, stock, and currency markets confirms that trends are the rule rather than the exception. The theory of perfect competition could be defended by arguing that the trends we can observe in commodity and financial markets are merely temporary aberrations which will be eliminated in the long run by the fundamental forces of supply and demand. It should be remembered that the theory of perfect competition does not claim to define the path of adjustment. It merely analyzes the situation after all the adjustments have taken place. The trouble with the argument is that there can be no assurance that fundamental forces will correct speculative excesses. It is just as possible that speculation will alter the supposedly fundamental conditions of supply and demand.